Chapter 113. The House in the Allée de Meillan. 10 leagues were passed without a single word being pronounced. Morel was dreaming, and Monte Cristo was looking at the dreamer. "Morel," said the Count to him at length, "do you repent having followed me?"
"No, Count, but to leave Paris."
"If I thought happiness might await you in Paris, Morel, I would have left you there."
"Valentine reposes within the walls of Paris, and to leave Paris is like losing her a second time."
"Maximilien," said the Count, "the friends that we have lost do not repose in the bosom of the earth, but are buried deep in our hearts, and it has been thus ordained that we may always be accompanied by them. I have 2 friends who in this way never depart from me, the one who gave me being, and the other who conferred knowledge and intelligence on me. Their spirits live in me. Listen to the voice of your heart, Morel, and ask it whether you ought to preserve this melancholy exterior towards me."
"My friend," said Maximilien, "the voice of my heart is very sorrowful, and points out the future in most unhappy colours."
"It is ever thus that weakened minds see everything as through a black veil. The soul forms its own horizons. Your soul is darkened, and consequently the sky of the future appears stormy and unpromising."
"That may possibly be true," said Maximilien,
and he again subsided into his thoughtful mood. The journey was performed with that marvellous rapidity which the unlimited power of the Count ever commanded. The following morning they arrived at Chalons, where the Count's steamboat waited for them. Without an instant being lost, the carriage was placed on board, and the 2 travellers embarked without delay. The boat was built for speed. Her 2 paddle wheels resembled 2 wings, with which she skimmed the water like a bird. Morel was not insensible to that sensation of delight which is generally experienced in passing rapidly through the air, and the wind which occasionally raised the hair from his forehead seemed on the point of dispelling momentarily the clouds collected there. As the distance increased between the travellers and Paris, an almost superhuman serenity appeared to surround the Count. He might have been taken for an exile about to revisit his native land. Ere long, Marseille presented herself to view. With 1 accord they stopped on the Canebière. A vessel was setting sail for Algiers, on board of which the bustle usually attending departure prevailed. The passengers and their relations crowded on the deck, friends taking a tender but sorrowful leave of each other, some weeping, others noisy in their grief, formed a spectacle, exciting even to those who witnessed similar ones daily, but which had not the power to disturb the current of thought that had taken possession of the mind of Maximilien from the moment he had set foot on the broad pavement of the quay.
"Here,"
said he, leaning heavily on the arm of Monte Cristo,
"here is the spot where my father stopped when the Pharaon entered the port. It was here that the good old man whom you saved from death and dishonour threw himself into my arms. I yet feel his warm tears on my face. And his were not the only tears shed, for many who witnessed our meeting wept also."
Monte Cristo gently smiled and said, "I was there," at the same time pointing to the corner of a street. As he spoke, and in the very direction he indicated, a groan expressive of bitter grief was heard, and a woman was seen waving her hand to a passenger on board the vessel about to sail. Monte Cristo looked at her with an emotion that must have been remarked by Morel, had not his eyes been fixed on the vessel.
"Oh, heavens!"
exclaimed Morel.
"I do not deceive myself. That young man who is waving his hat, that youth in the uniform of a lieutenant, is Albert de Morcerf."
"Yes," said Monte Cristo, "I recognized him."
"How so? You were looking the other way."
The Count smiled, as he was in the habit of doing when he did not wish to make any reply, and he again turned his looks towards the veiled female, who soon disappeared at the corner of the street. Turning to his friend, "Dear Maximilien," said the Count, "have you nothing to do in this land?"
"I have to weep over the grave of my father," replied Morel in a broken voice.
"Well, then, go. Wait for me there, and I will soon join you. I have a pious visit to pay." Morel allowed his hand to fall into that which the Count extended to him. Then, with an inexpressibly melancholy inclination of the head, he quitted the Count and bent his steps to the east of the city. Monte Cristo remained on the same spot until Maximilien was out of sight. He then walked slowly towards the Allée de Meillan to seek out a small house with which our readers must have been familiar at the commencement of this story. It yet stood under the shade of the fine avenue of lime trees, which forms one of the most frequented walks of the idlers of Marseille, covered by an immense vine which spread its aged and blackened branches over the stone front, burnt yellow by the ardent sun of the south. Two stone steps, worn away by the friction of the feet, led to the door, made of three planks, which, owing to their never having made acquaintance with paint or varnish, parted annually to reunite again when the damp season arrived. This house, with all its crumbling antiquity and apparent misery, was yet cheerful and picturesque, and was the same that old Dantès formerly inhabited, the only difference being that the old man occupied merely the garret, while the whole house was now placed at the command of Mercedes by the Count. The female whom the Count had seen leave the ship with so much regret entered this house. She had scarcely closed the door after her when Monte Cristo appeared at the corner of a street, so that he found and lost her again almost at the same instant. The worn-out steps were old acquaintances of his. He knew better than anyone else how to open that weather-beaten door with a large-headed nail which served to raise the latch within. He entered without knocking or giving any other intimation of his presence, as if he had been the friend or the master of the place. At the end of a passage, paved with bricks, was seen a little garden, bathed in sunshine and rich in warmth and light. It was in this garden that Mercedes found, in the place indicated by the Count, the sum of money which he, through a sense of delicacy, intimated had been placed there 24 years previously. The trees of the garden were easily seen from the steps of the street door. Monte Cristo, on stepping into the house, heard a sigh almost resembling a deep sob. He looked in the direction whence it came, and there, under an arbor of Virginian jessamine, with a thick foliage and beautiful long purple flowers, he perceived Mercedes seated, with her head bowed and weeping bitterly. She had raised her veil, and with her face hidden by her hands, was giving free scope to those sighs and tears which had been so long restrained by the presence of her son. Monte Cristo advanced a few paces, which were heard on the gravel. Mercedes raised her head and uttered a cry of terror on beholding a man before her. "Madame," said the Count, "it is no longer in my power to restore you to happiness, but I offer you consolation. Will you deign to accept it as coming from a friend?"
"I am indeed most wretched," replied Mercedes. "Alone in the world, I had but my son, and he has left me."
"He possesses a noble heart, madame," replied the Count, "and he has acted rightly. He feels that every man owes a tribute to his country. Had he remained with you, his life must have become a hateful burden, nor would he have participated in your griefs. He will increase in strength and honour by struggling with adversity, which he will convert into prosperity. Leave him to build up the future for you, and I venture to say you will confide it to safe hands."
"Oh," replied the wretched woman, mournfully shaking her head, "the prosperity of which you speak, and which, from the bottom of my heart, I pray God in his mercy to grant him, I can never enjoy. The bitter cup of adversity has been drained by me to the very dregs, and I feel that the grave is not far distant. You have acted kindly, Count, in bringing me back to the place where I have enjoyed so much bliss. I ought to meet death on the same spot where happiness was once all my own."
"Alas," said Monte Cristo, "your words sear and embitter my heart, the more so as you have every reason to hate me. I have been the cause of all your misfortunes. But why do you pity instead of blame me? You render me still more unhappy."
"Hate you? Blame you? You, Edmund? Hate, reproach the man that has spared my son's life, for was it not your fatal and sanguinary intention to destroy that son of whom Monsieur de Morcerf was so proud? Oh, look at me well, and discover, if you can, even the semblance of a reproach in me."
The Count looked up, and fixed his eyes on Mercedes, who, partly rising from her seat, extended both her hands towards him.
"Oh, look at me," continued she, with a feeling of profound melancholy. "My eyes no longer dazzle by their brilliancy, for the time has long fled since I used to smile on Edmond Dantès, who anxiously looked out for me from the window of yonder garret, then inhabited by his old father. Years of grief have created an abyss between those days and the present. I neither reproach you nor hate you, my friend. Oh, no, Edmond, it is myself that I blame, myself that I hate. "Oh, miserable creature that I am!" cried she, clasping her hands and raising her eyes to heaven. "I once possessed piety, innocence, and love, the three ingredients of the happiness of angels, and now what am I?"
Monte Cristo approached her and silently took her hand.
"No," said she, withdrawing it gently. "No, my friend, touch me not. You have spared me, yet of all those who have fallen under your vengeance, I was the most guilty. They were influenced by hatred, by avarice, and by self-love. But I was base, and, for want of courage, acted against my judgment. Nay, do not press my hand, Edmund. You are thinking of some kind expression, I am sure, to console me, but do not bestow it on me, for I am no longer worthy of kindness. See,"
and she exposed her face completely to view,
"see, misfortune has silvered my hair. My eyes have shed so many tears that they are encircled by a rim of purple, and my brow is wrinkled. You, Edmund, on the contrary, you are still young, handsome, dignified. It is because you have never doubted the mercy of God, and he has supported and strengthened you in all your trials."
As Mercedes spoke, the tears chased each other down her wan cheeks. The unhappy woman's heart was breaking as memory recalled the changeful events of her life. Monte Cristo, however, took her hand and imprinted a kiss on it. But she herself felt that it was with no greater warmth than he would have respectfully bestowed on the hand of some marble statue of a saint.
"It often happens," continued she, "that a first fault destroys the prospects of a whole life. I believed you dead. Why did I survive you? What good has it done me to mourn for you eternally in the secret recesses of my heart, only to make a woman of 39 look like one of 50 years of age? Why, having recognized you, and I the only one to do so, why was I able to save my son alone? Ought I not also to have rescued the man that I had accepted for a husband, guilty though he were, son alone? Ought I not also to have rescued the... Yet I let him die. What do I say? Oh, merciful heavens, was I not accessory to his death by my supine insensibility, by my contempt for him, not remembering or not willing to remember that it was for my sake he had become a traitor and perjurer? In what am I benefited by accompanying my son so far, since I now abandon him and allow him to depart alone to the baneful climate of Africa? Oh, I have been base. Cowardly, I tell you, I have abjured my affections, and, like all renegades, I am of evil omen to those who surround me."
"No, Mercedes," said Monte Cristo. "No, you judge yourself with too much severity. You are a noble-minded woman, and it was your grief that disarmed me. Still, I was but an agent, led on by an invisible and offended deity, who chose not to withhold the fatal blow that I was destined to hurl. I take that God to witness, at whose feet I have prostrated myself daily for the last 10 years, that I would have sacrificed my life to you, and, with my life, the projects that were indissolubly linked with it, but in the present, and endeavour to pierce futurity, and then say whether I am not a divine instrument. The most dreadful misfortunes, the most frightful sufferings, the abandonment of all those who loved me, the persecution of those who did not know me, formed the trials of my youth, when suddenly from captivity, solitude, misery, I was restored to light and liberty, and became the possessor of a fortune so brilliant, so un-misery I was restored of, that I must have been became the possessor of conscious that God had endowed me with it to work out his own great designs. From that time I viewed this fortune as confided to me for a particular purpose. Not a thought was given to a life which you once, Mercedes, had the power to render blissful, particular purpose. Not a thought, but I felt myself driven on like an exterminating angel. Like those adventurous captains about to embark on some enterprise full of danger, I laid in my provisions, I loaded my arms, I collected every means of attack and defence, I inured my body to the most violent exercises, my soul to the bitterest trials, I taught my arm to slay, my eyes to behold excruciating sufferings, and my mouth to smile at the most horrid spectacles. From good-natured, confiding and forgiving, I became revengeful, cunning and wicked, or rather immovable as fate. Then I launched out into the path that was opened to me. I overcame every obstacle and reached the goal, but woe to those who met me in my career.
Enough, said Mercedes. Enough, Edmond.
Believe me, but woe to those who met me in my career.
Enough, said Mercedes. Enough, Edmond. And you had crushed her that like a whale and recognized you as being the only one to... Still, she must have admired she like lost your path. Me and the past, there is an abyss between you, Edmond, and the rest of mankind. And I tell you freely that the comparison I drew between you and the other men will ever be one of my greatest tortures. No, there is nothing in the world to resemble you in worth and goodness. But we must say farewell, Edmund, and let us part.
Before I leave you, Mercedes, have you no request to make? Said the Count.
I desire but one thing in this world, Edmund.
Before I leave you, Mercedes, have you no request to make? Count.
I desire but one thing in this
and
world.
Take upon myself to promote his happiness.
Thanks. Thanks, Edmund.
But have you no request to make for yourself, Mercedes?
For myself I want nothing. I live, as it were, between two graves. The one, that of Edmond Dantès, lost to me long, long since. He had my love. That word ill becomes my faded lip now, but it is a memory dear to my heart, and one that I... My love. That word ill becomes my faded lip now, but it is a memory dear to my heart, and one that I would not lose for all that the world contains of thee. The other grave is that of the man who dead.
Yes, your son shall be happy, Mercedes, repeated the Count.
Then I shall enjoy as much happiness as this world can possibly confer.
But what are your intentions?
To say that I shall live here, like the Mercedes of other times, gaining my bread by labour, would not be true, nor would you believe me. I have no longer the strength to do anything but to spend my days in prayer. However, I shall have no occasion to work, for the little sum of money buried by you, and which I found in the place you mentioned, will be sufficient to maintain me. Rumour will probably be busy respecting me, my occupations, my manner of living, to maintain me. Rumour.
Mercedes, said the Count, I do not say it to blame you, but you made an unnecessary sacrifice in relinquishing the whole of the fortune amassed by Monsieur de Morcerf. Half of it, at least, by right belonged to you, in virtue of your vigilance and economy.
I perceive what you are intending to propose to me, but I cannot accept it, Edmund. My son would not permit it.
Nothing shall be done without the full approbation of Albert de Morcerf. I will make myself acquainted with his intentions and will submit to them, but if he will be willing to accept my offers, will you oppose them?
You know well, Edmund, that I am no longer a reasoning creature. I have no will, unless it be the will never to decide. I have been so overwhelmed by the many storms that have broken over my head that I am become passive in the hands of the Almighty, like a sparrow in the talons of an eagle. I live because it is not ordained for me to die. If succour be sent to me, I will accept it.
Ah, madame, said Monte Cristo, you should not talk thus. It is not so we should evince our resignation to the will of heaven. On the contrary, we are all free agents.
Alas, exclaimed Mercedes, if it were so, if I possessed free will, but without the power
free agent
that will efficacious, it would drive me to
Mercedes. Monte Cristo dropped his head and shrank from the vehemence of her grief. "Will you not even say you will see me again?" he asked.
"On the contrary, we shall meet again," said Mercedes,
pointing to heaven with solemnity.
"I tell you so to prove to you that I still hope."
And after pressing her own trembling hand upon that of the Count, Monte Cristo slowly left the Count and turned towards the quay. But Mercedes saw not his departure, though she was seated at the little window of the room which had been occupied by old Dantès. But Mercedes saw straining to see the ship, though she was seated at the over the vast sea, occupied by old Dantès. Her eyes were straining to see the ship which was carrying her son over the vast sea. But still her voice involuntarily murmured softly,
"Edmund, Edmund, Edmund."
Probably never to behold her again. The Count departed with a sad heart from the house in which he had left Mercedes, probably never to behold her again. He turned towards the cemetery, where he felt sure of finding piously sought out a tomb, and sought it vainly. He who returned to France with millions had been unable to find the grave of his father, who had perished from hunger. Morel had indeed placed a cross over the spot, but it had fallen down, and the gravedigger had burnt it, as he did all the old wood in the churchyard. The worthy merchant had been more fortunate. Dying in the arms of his children, he had been by them laid by the side of his wife, who had preceded him in eternity by 2 years. Two large slabs of marble, on which were inscribed their names, were placed on either side of a little enclosure, railed in, and shaded by 4 cypress trees. Morel was leaning against one of these, mechanically fixing his eyes on the graves. His grief was so profound he was nearly unconscious. "Maximilien," said the Count, "you should not look on the graves, but there," and he pointed upwards.
"The dead are everywhere," said Morel. "Did you not yourself tell me so as we left Paris?"
"Maximilien," said the Count,
"you asked me during the journey to allow you to remain some days at Marseille. Do you still wish to do so?" "I have no wishes, Count, only I fancy I could pass the time less painfully here than anywhere else."
"So much the better, for I must leave you, but I carry your word with me, do I not?"
"You have my promise,"
he said after a minute's pause, extending his hand to Monte Cristo.
"Only remember—"
"On the 5th of October, Morel, I shall expect you at the island of Monte Cristo. On the 4th, a yacht will wait for you in the port of Bastia. It will be called the Eurus. You will deliver your name to the captain, who will bring you to me. It is understood, is it not?"
"But, Count, do you remember that the 5th of October—"
"Child," replied the Count, "not to know the value of a man's word. I have told you 20 times that if you wish to die on that day, I will assist you. Morel, farewell."
"Do you leave me?"
"Yes, I have business in Italy. I leave you alone with your misfortunes and with hope, Maximilien."
"When do you leave?"
"Immediately. The steamer waits, and in an hour I shall be far from you. Will you accompany me to the harbour, Maximilien?"
"I am entirely yours, Count."
Morel accompanied the Count to the harbour. The white steam was ascending like a plume of feathers from the black chimney. The steamer soon disappeared, and in an hour afterwards, as the Count had said, was scarcely distinguishable in the horizon amidst the fogs of the night.
End of Disc 34.